Radio City. John Grayson, Rob Ross with you once again, talking over everything going on in the pop culture world and beyond. And Rob Ross, how's everything shaking in New York City?
Not shaken as much as it had been over the last 72 hours because I was as sick as a dog.
Oh, man.
And I had a fever, which I have no idea how that came on. I'd fought a cold, which decimated my entire office. I mean, even our guy in Philadelphia had the cold, so he must have caught it through the interwebs, I guess.
Probably, yeah. He got a computer virus.
And now for the sacred word, Fenneman.
That's right. What they want.
And the word of the day is DeSoto. you know, I just felt absolutely wretched. And, you know, by yesterday, I was still, in fact, a bit shaky. I was really having a bad time grocery shopping. But when I came home, a cool thing kind of happened. I was, you know, flipping channels. And I came upon something that you and I have talked about because it's sorely missing in modern culture, and certainly our children and our children's children's generation don't seem to have the joy of discovering something like good old-fashioned Warner Brothers cartoons.
Yeah.
And for the first time in years, and it was so nice to watch it on a big flat screen, I came across classics like The Wabbit of Seville, People Are Funny, was one of the ones with the big chicken, you know, the one with the weasel. With the weasel,
right.
With that sick little weasel, and the dog, of course. Oh, and you know how they also had like the early Wile E. Coyote trying to steal sheep from the sheepdog who they were best friends.
Right,
they punch in and punch out. I think they were called Ralph and Sam.
Yep,
and that was also shown in a half hour span, and I thought, wow. This is a good tonic, a good elixir for my ills.
You know, it's funny you should mention that because just a couple of days ago, I was talking with my producer for the radio show, and he mentioned something that we both kind of had to pause for a second and try to put back together because it was the primetime Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember they did it for a couple of summers, actually. Which was great. I think it was the summer of 74. It was on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock.
Yep.
And, you know, of course it was the ever-loving Overture, Return the Light.
Yeah,
this
right.
is it, the night of night.
Overture.
And then, of course, the little march where all the characters come out. You gotta love that. You have to love that. I mean, it was just great. And then remember, they actually turned that into like a 2-hour, you know, powerhouse on Saturday mornings.
Yes, right.
That was CBS. That was the beauty of Saturdays. And always in September, early September, you look forward to seeing what they were going to have coming on. But you always hoped somewhere in there was going to be Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Show. And it was always between CBS and ABC.
Right. Yeah, and all of the cartoons were great. I mean, the Jay Ward stuff I gravitated toward a little bit later on, but still absolutely loved it and still do. But, the Warner Brothers stuff is just absolutely classic. So, you know, when it came to that era of the mid-70s, not only did you have the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour in primetime, but there was also a cartoon called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
Which was a primetime cartoon.
Right,
actually.
Exactly. It was a family, you know, I think it was at 7:30 Eastern time that thing would air.
NBC. Tom Bosley, I think, was the father.
Yeah, and it was great. That's one I have not seen make a resurgence yet. Everything else has popped up on DVD or popped up on Boomerang or something else like that. But Wait Till Your Father Gets Home, curiously enough, just seems to be in
Emily
the ether.
Ferdin was the daughter. I remember that much because she was the original voice of Lucy Van Pelt.
Yep. And my sister loved it. She absolutely loved that thing, and I kind of got into it because of her. So, yeah, not bad. But, again, where is it now? Who knows? It's got to be on Hulu or something.
I remember it was brought back very briefly on one of those revival channels. We're talking about at least 30 years ago when it was first kind of the in thing to do.
Yeah.
When Nick at Night first appeared.
Right.
Or Nickelodeon's TV Land. That was it. But I always thought that Wait Till Your Father Gets Home was the direct descendant of Family Guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. The through lines being drawn because the characters, you know, the difference with Family Guy, obviously, has got a lot more dirty stuff and adult references in it. But still, that idea of the goofy father who kind of means well and all of that. Yeah. It goes back directly to Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
The thing about Seth MacFarlane, that bastard, is that he's just going to milk the 80s for every pop culture reference he can.
Right.
And that's all he ever really does. But you know what? Family Guy has made me laugh to no end. I actually far and away prefer Family Guy to The Simpsons. I never really got into The Simpsons, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
The only thing I can say that I like about Matt Groening is that he's a huge Captain Beefheart fan, which, you know, that makes a lot of sense, certainly. But, you know, it's just the whole idea that, you know, I'm 53, I'm sitting there, I'm sick as a dog. And I felt so much better just watching and laughing at these cartoons because, of course, I know so many of these lines.
Yep.
Like, Wabbit of Seville. Who's not singing along with, you know, let me trim your crop, let me show your mop daintily. Yeah, I mean, come on. It's just so classic, and that's so ingrained in all of us.
Yeah. Well, we went to a comic book convention over the weekend called Wizard World, and it's one of these traveling things, and it happened to be in St. Louis for the last 4 days, so we had free passes and went and just had a brilliant time. But there are these little things. You know what pops are?
Not sure.
Little action figure type things, and they have huge heads. And there are a bunch of them. I mean, there's Star Wars ones, and there's the old Warner Brothers cartoon ones, and, you know, a little bit of everything. And they had, they're kind of like bobbleheads. They're the new version of bobbleheads, but they're a little bit shorter than that. And they had the Warner Brothers characters from Rabbit of Seville. It wasn't just a Bugs Bunny. It was Bugs Bunny in the opera costume.
Oh, from What's Opera Doc?
From What's Opera Doc, right, exactly.
Yeah. Toyota Ho.
But, yeah, I mean, those things are, I guess, they're the cool pop culture thing of the moment. I'm sure they'll go the way of Beanie Babies sooner or later.
Ugh, Beanie Babies. No, but, you know, now you brought up What's Opera Doc, and all I'm thinking, of course, is Kill the Wabbit.
Right.
Kill the Wabbit. Who doesn't know the songs? It's like, not long ago, I'd say maybe 6 or 7 months ago, one of my friends who is of our age bracket, brought up, he couldn't remember, and he couldn't make the exact reference, an old Daffy Duck cartoon in which it was a bunch of books.
Okay.
And Daffy Duck is basically telling the story of Little Red Riding Hood. But there's all these other books that are around that kind of help him tell the story. And I knew exactly what he was referring to. He was referring to the cartoon called Book Review, in which the most famous or infamous moment is he does Danny Kaye. No perfect. When Danny Kaye did his whole I Romania shtick.
Uh-huh.
And it was where, Daffy Duck puts on this act and he's like, the gypsies, they would sing a little song that went something like this. Cucaracha! You
know? Yes, I remember that. Well, see, and that again is part of the brilliance of Mel Blanc. I mean, we could sit here for hours and talk about what an unbelievable talent Mel Blanc was. But the fact that he could not only do those voices, but he could do accents in them. You got to understand what an incredibly difficult thing that is to pull off. And he did it with it like it was nothing. What do you need me to do?
It was, when you watched him do it, though, what was so great about it was, and it's still exciting, is that he was doing all the characters at once, having the conversations
right
as he's doing it, like without missing a beat. It's not like he's looking at the page and needing to reference the script. He's going from being, you know, the pig to the Fudd to the Yosemite Sam to the duck to the Wabbit and back again, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's magnificent. And the fact that, you know, of course, because I have such an appreciation for Borscht Belt humor, you know, I had to go back and find Book Review just so I could watch him do the whole thing, you know. Yeah. Nothing could be thinner than to be in Carolina anymore. Just fucking genius.
Right.
That's all you could say about it. And the thing is that unfortunately, you and I and our generation are the last that have the cultural references that go along with it from our parents and our grandparents.
Right. And part of the reason for that is because, well, first of all, there's just so much anymore. When it comes to pop culture, you could go off in 1,000 different directions. There's a million channels and there's as many shows on them. So there's no, and with streaming, you know, we had this conversation off the air a while back about the fact that there is no such thing anymore as a universally shared experience. There will never ever again be. I guess the closest thing to it right now is probably the "How did the dad die" on This Is Us, but there will never ever again be another Who Shot JR, because right. people are so distracted by all kinds of other shit. And, you know, if 10% of the people are watching something, it's a vast number because there's just that much shit to watch. So it's hard to do that. It's hard to make a reference to something like a Danny Kaye movie because you figure you'll miss 95% of the audience if you do it.
Which is really sad. You know, I always have to temper what I say to people in just basic conversation, you know, nice, pleasant conversations. But, you know, I always want to make one of those references because they bring up something that automatically triggers that you know, that moment of humor or that bright spot. You know, it's like I've always said, 90% when people say to me, "God, you're so funny." And I was like, "Well, I don't write my own shtick." You know, I've always said the same thing. I steal all my stuff from the same sources over and over again, and it's served me well.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to steal from the best.
Right. It's always going to be the Monkees, the Munsters, MASH. A predominant amount from MASH, the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the Flintstones.
And Groucho Marx. Yeah, right.
Well, occasionally. But, you know, but only because, you know, watching reruns of You Bet Your Life, you know, you can't help it. You know?
Yeah.
Because that'll start imitating Harold Pira going, "Well!" And nobody's going to get that either.
Yeah, well, now, as we're talking, the Super Bowl is now a day old, and once again, we have seen that the AFC East cannot cover the spread in a Super Bowl against an NFC East team. It just can't happen, and not only did the New England Patriots fail to cover the spread, they lost the damn game, which is fine by me, but that just means that the Eagles are now Super Bowl champions, so meh.
But it's only for a year.
You know, also true.
You know, so that'll be over with soon enough. I mean, the thing is, you know, ironically, and they kept talking about it during the game, Brady didn't get picked off per se. He just got the ball knocked out of his hands
yep.
for the turnover, and that was the end.
Right.
Of all things, a cheap little play like that cost him the Super Bowl.
And he had not been sacked at all up until that point.
No.
So, yeah, if you're going to do it, make it count. And the other interesting thing about that, I guess, from a statistical – well, not even from a statistical standpoint, but just from a viewership standpoint, I wasn't going to watch any of it, but we ended up going out to dinner at a place that happened to have the game on. So we saw part of the second quarter there, and I saw most of the last part of the game. And for God's sake, Chris Collinsworth, could you be any more up Brady and Belichick's ass? Please stop. He's
those
terrible.
Those guys are just appallingly bad. I swear. They're just so, so horrible. You know, there's just such a lack of quality, you know, when it comes to national broadcasts, all announcers just suck.
Yeah,
you know, listening to Mike Emmerich makes me want to just blow my fucking brains out because, A, I never liked him when he called the Devils games locally on MSG/Sports Channel or whatever the hell they called it. And now it's, you know, MSG, MSG2, et cetera, et cetera. They're all on the same network. And whenever it comes to the Rangers, he always has to pull his homer shit because he so hates the Rangers. That's number one. Number two, you know, he's one of those assholes that always has to say stupid things like, "And there's, you know, another 85 seconds left in this game. Just call it a minute and 25 seconds like normal people."
Wow, you can do math.
You know, Jesus. But there's just something grating about him in general. It's almost like this sycophantic bent that he has.
Yeah.
And he's always on the goddamn NBC games. You know, so of course, if the Rangers are playing a national game, A, I know they're going to lose, you know, and embarrass me even more. than they would if they were just on MSG. And B, we're going to have to listen to fucking Emmerich, you know?
Yes, these are the crosses we all have to bear. But, you know, as far as the game itself went, or what little we saw of it, and I'm,
it was boring. Yeah. It was a boring game. It was, there was just nothing dynamic about it, you know, and I could have given less than a shit. And the halftime show, that was just nothing. If I'm going to say one thing about the entire evening, I was absolutely moved by Pink's performance of the national anthem. She was amazing.
Her and she voice, was sick.
Yeah, that stunned me. Absolutely stunned me. And then it dawned on me later on, oh, I know why she sang it, because she's from the Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. But God, she did such a beautiful job. You know, it, you can't help but feel patriotic when you hear somebody like her deliver that kind of powerful performance.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, another year over with in the NFL, and they've got a lot of shit to sort out. I mean, the one thing that, you know, the Collinsworth did say that makes a little bit of sense is that they need to figure this what's a catch and what isn't thing. They need to define it down a little bit further, because there's just so many times, not only twice in this game, but just in every game you watch, where something that looks like a catch is ruled not one. And if it was out on the sand lot, you know, or where we all used to play as kids, it would have been a catch. And if both feet are inbounds and the guy looks like he caught the ball, give him the damn catch.
Now, this is a pet theme of yours, because how many shows have we done where this always crops up,
yep,
right? And how many times have I actually followed suit with saying, you saw what happened with the Jets game? And those calls always seem to get overturned on our guys. Now, isn't it ironic that this is the first time it got called a catch against the Patriots?
Yeah, right. Not once, but twice. And, of course, Collinsworth there going, I don't even know how they could say that's a catch. It's like, shut up. But, they've got the team meetings coming up. They've got the ownership meetings coming up about a month away. And they have to sit down and hammer this stuff out, because the more they go through this and the more they keep giving the appearance, even if they're not, even if they called it exactly fair and exactly down the line, the more they give the appearance that they're trying to get involved in the game and fuck up the outcome, the more they're going to lose viewership.
Well, I'll tell you what. There are a ton of places in Staten Island that were boycotting a ton of bars, and sports bars specifically, that were boycotting the Super Bowl.
Yep.
So I don't know how prevalent that was elsewhere, but usually, you know, it's considered a sacred holiday. But, you know, this is a very – I don't want to call this a conservative borough, but it is, you know, they felt that the way that the players have acted this season, they've put their own personal political agendas ahead of the game and ahead of the basic simple respect for standing when the national anthem is being played. They put it very simply. It wasn't a big, you know, fuck you or Kaepernick kind of thing or what have you. They all said it was all basically the same general consensus. There are some things that you do not do. You know, this is an insult to veterans, you know, especially wounded veterans who may be friends, neighbors, relatives of yours. You know, it's a slap in the face. I happen to agree with that. But that's also because I remember when I was a kid, and I may have told this story once before, we went to a Mets game, and my cousin Mark didn't want to get up for the national anthem. It was the Mets versus the Expos. Mark was 14 at the time, 14 or 15, but he was trying really hard to be, you know, a typical teenager of the 70s. You know, he missed the hippie boat, so he was trying to be, you know, Mr. Right on Politics. And my father, who was, you know, who served in the Korean War, wasn't having any of that. My dad whacked him a good one and said, you're going to get your ass up and you're going to stand. He stood.
Yeah.
Every goddamn baseball game that Mark and I have gone to ever since, he stands for the national anthem.
Yeah, well, and there's so much that gets lost over time, because the one that gets me is not so much the political statement, because political statements don't bother me. However,
and most people right now, I will say this much, most people who make political statements are all jumping on a bandwagon for the moment.
Which is why I don't really pay that much attention to them. But if you're going to stand up during the national anthem, if you're going to go to the game and you're going to try to play the I'm patriotic and I'm standing with my hand over my heart or whatever for the national anthem, take your fucking hat off, please.
Yeah, You know, do what's right. You go to a baseball game, you see all the guys standing there with the caps on their chests, right, the way it's supposed to be. The Nimrods in the stands are like, basic chuds who don't have a sense of decency. I'm sure they will sit at the dinner table with their hats on anyway.
Yeah, probably also true because they had no mothers, or at least no effective ones. So,
and also because they're all probably bald.
Right. They don't want to get a sunburn up there.
I swear to God, I think that's what may have saved me from going bald at an early age, because God knows I basically, you know, did everything, even take a bath in a baseball cap as a kid.
Yep.
But once I lost my interest in baseball and got into both women and music around the age of 11 or 12, I didn't wear a baseball cap until the Mets won a World Series again.
Yeah.
So that was a long fucking time. And,
on the subject of political statements, though, the other thing that happened a little over a week ago now was the Grammys. And we've been over award shows. I've been over award shows forever. I never had that much affinity for them in the first place, but didn't bother to watch the Grammys this year. And honestly, because of all of the flap and the aftermath, I'm glad I didn't.
It was just such another outward – it was a performance, again, of glad-handing and aren't we wonderful.
A stroke fest.
Such, oh my God, it was like the biggest circle jerk I've seen yet. I can't wait until the Oscars. Imagine how many people are going to be blowing each other.
Right.
Right there on camera. I mean, you know, all these assholes with their Me Too and Time's Up and hashtag. And you know what? You're all so full of shit. And by the way, the music that was out there this year, you all suck. You are all just absolutely appallingly bad.
Right.
Bad musicians, strike that. You know, edit that line out. I'm saying strike it and edit it, because these are not musicians. These are just studio creations tossed out there to make a quick buck. I mean, I want to know, what is a Cardi B?
Yeah, and the only – I mean, it's – I guess it was fitting that, if I get it right, Bruno Mars was the one who won the most stuff.
Right, and Jay-Z got Jack, which is short for Jack Shit.
Good, and that's fine, because Bruno Mars – is a good performer. I'm not going to argue that.
And a good singer. And he's got a personality.
Right, exactly. So he's great at the showman part of pop music. However, there should be more out there than just pop music. And that's where it loses me a little bit, because beyond him, there's nothing. I mean, you hit it absolutely accurately. And the fact is, Bruno Mars should have won some awards. You know what I mean? But there should have been enough competition out there to say, you know what, somebody else is good enough to win, because he is not – what he is a very good performer and a very good singer. What he's not is the best thing music has ever seen. And if you're going to win that many awards at the Grammys, that's what you ought to be.
The other thing is this. You know, you look at somebody like Jay-Z, who collective amnesia seems to take hold of everybody. He was a pimp and a pusher.
Yep.
You know? Hashtag, are you all fucking retarded? How soon and so easily you forget.
Yeah.
You know? So fuck you all. Fuck you all from my former industry. I really am not at all sad that I'm not part of it anymore, because you bring shame upon every one of us who actually went out there as evangelicals to do God's work in the music industry.
Right. Well, and the thing is, we know, because we do this and because you write for Popdos and write articles on new music, that there is good, solid new music out there. There are creative artists and creative people who are making great things to listen to almost nonstop. And the sad part is, those people used to be able to feed themselves.
The other thing is this. One, these are people who are making these sounds with real instruments. Yep. They're taking the time to learn how to play and master their instruments, how to write and create and construct songs, how to sing without auto-tune, etc., etc. You know, these are people that are not going to go out there and you pay $300, $400 for a ticket to have them lip-syncing to a backing track, which is just beyond appalling to me. That's a crime in and of itself.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, you just said these are people who used to be able to feed themselves. There are people that we grew up with that we used to pay to see, that, hell, even our parents may have paid to see, that don't get paid anymore simply because records don't sell, and they're not touring. So whatever they have left, they have to hold on to and try and find other ways of making money off of what they used to do, because it has shrunk. The window has closed, basically.
Well, don't forget, though, I mean, Kanye West is the greatest musician who ever lived. He'll tell you. I don't know what the fuck he plays.
But I'll tell you what he plays with himself.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, you heard me. Fuck you, Kanye West.
Uh-huh.
Go fuck yourself. You suck, too, you piece of shit.
And I don't know. I mean, I like to think that if the options were out there, people would make better choices. But, you know, we all live through the disco era, too, so.
But you know what? As much as at the time disco pained me and angered me, I can go back now and still enjoy a lot of those classic great disco records. You know, shit like, you know, by the Gap Band or Chic or, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire. You know, those records had some motor to them. They had some groove, you know, and they were made by real musicians.
Yeah, you know? Because there wasn't any alternative. You had to play, you know, somebody had to make those sounds. So, the Grammys, I've had enough. One of these days they can wake me and show me something new, but I'm not going to hold my breath for it.
Yeah, don't, because you'll probably die in the process.
Now, that does, though, lead us into some new music, because you found a band, a German band that we're going to talk about a little bit. Who is Jaguar?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to set this up by saying, remember how very recently we talked about what's that band? Death of Lovers?
Yes.
Okay, and how much they had that early 80s sound down pat and refined, and it sounded like it just walked right out of 1980, 81, 82.
Yeah.
Full stop. Here's another one.
Great.
And they're that good, if not even a little better. So yeah, they're a German trio. They formed in 2012. The thing is that they use kind of as their stock in trade is that they're not just that early 80s sound that we love so much, but they do have a lot of the shoegazer influence. So it's kind of like a nice little ride through the early to mid 80s. It takes you that little bit further out.
Yeah.
You know, except, okay, it's not as abrasive as My Bloody Valentine. Think more bands like Lush or Curve, you know, those type of shoegazer bands. Or the very first things by Blur, you know, when they were still trying to find their feet.
Yeah.
Before they became Blur, you know.
Yeah, and what I loved about this, the track that you've got on the review page, is the layering late in the song, the vocal layering is outstanding. And it's really tricky to do that when you use as much wetness in the vocals, when you use as much reverb and slapback as they do to achieve that early 80s sound that you were talking about, because you can muddy it up really easily and make it unlistenable, because it just it becomes something that you can't separate. Your brain can't separate one voice from another. The way they do it, and I don't know who's running the studio where these guys recorded this stuff, but they know what the hell they're doing, because you can still pick out the individual voices, but the layering is interesting, it makes sense, and it never loses you, it never gets muddy.
The wonderful thing about this album, as I looked at it and as I listened to it, you know, it starts off on all the right flavors, you know?
Yeah.
As I put it, it's an enjoyable sensory assault, you know? It's the kind of thing you want and need. It's like, okay, I missed this. It's been a long time, but let me strap myself into the roller coaster and go on the ride.
Right.
Because I missed this, you know? But it's you know, they've got that kind of knowledge, if you will. They know how to walk that balance, because there's one track called Crystal that sounds like the perfect melding. And because they have a female singer, this is completely accurate. The perfect melding of The Cure and Susie and the Banshees in that period before both bands started to suck. You know, we're talking about The Cure up to around, I'll go as far as Charlotte Sometimes, because that was their last great moment.
Yep.
Truly great moment. You know, so it was, you know, The Cure of 17 seconds, where they still had the pace, but now they were a lot cleaner sounding. I mean, I will always love the first album, Boys Don't Cry / Three Imaginary Boys, but 17 Seconds was really coherent. And you have that moment of the Banshees where they were absolutely perfect with the album Kaleidoscope. So if you put those two together, you've got a jackpot right there. But then there's a track on there, and the one that really just stood out to me the most was Away, which is to me the perfect mixture of the sound, the Comsat Angels, the Chameleons, the first two albums by U2, because people forget how good U2 actually were on their first two records.
Right.
Their last great moment was the single A Celebration, and then they turned into U2, and fuck those guys as well.
So. But Jaguar, definitely well worth the listen, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the album because I've only heard the one track, but still, that held a lot of promise for me. And you're right, it just felt comfortable. It was a very nice trip backwards.
And I'll tell you something, even if for argument's sake, if you weren't that much of a fan of that sound, it's the quality of the songs and the performances. And that's the beauty of what we do. And I don't mean to get on a soapbox about Poptos, but you know, certainly what I try to do is when I get this new music, whether it's something that's a throwback to early 80s, you know, echo pop, you know, or muted Americana, or just plain weirdness, the fact is that there are people out there with the talent who've invested their time and energy, never mind what money they probably had to put into it themselves. It's the fact that what we try to do is we try to bring more of this to you so that way you look beyond the idiocy and the perimeters of what you're being force-fed day after day after day.
Right.
Because what's out there right now that people are, quote, aware of is total shit. It's garbage. Not everything is that awful, but I would say 90% of it is.
Well, yeah, and as a sort of proof of concept of that, did you watch Saturday Night Live this week?
I refuse to watch Saturday Night Live now, actually. Okay. I will not watch it.
There was, I don't even know the name of the performer, but she was another in a long line of lords and, you know, that ilk where she's very pretty, she's very tall, she's very young, she has long flowing brown hair, and her voice is adequate. It's nothing you wouldn't hear in any karaoke club, you know. She sounds fine. The music was dull. The lyrics were dull and self-indulgent. And my wife was sitting there on the couch with me watching this, and we both got bored with it about 10 seconds in and looked at each other and went, yeah, sure, and hit fast forward because there was no reason not to. And this is a girl who's on national television. You know,
well, I mean, let's not forget when Lana Del Rey made her debut appearance on Saturday Night Live, and what a disaster it was.
Yeah, it was terrible because the song sucked, and she was terrible. So yeah,
the irony being that, believe it or not, I met her. She came into my office because my accountant was her manager / accountant at the time before she became Lana Del Rey.
Uh-huh.
Liz Grant is her name,
right?
And she was absolutely lovely, a total sweetheart. You know, asking very pointed questions to me about the music industry and what it was like, because she was a little apprehensive because this was just as she was signing her first album deal.
Okay.
A very, very nice young woman. But boy, they just played her up to being this. I don't know what the hell they're trying to make her out to be. Insufferable?
Right. Well, if that's what they're going for, nailed it.
They did it. And the songs are just awful. And I do mean awful. What was it? Video Game, I think, was the name of the song that quote, put her on the map.
Well, yeah.
You know what? Napoleon, what was it, the 14th, had a song called They're Coming to Take Me Away, ha ha ho ho yee-haw. That put him on the map, too.
Yeah. Well, and it's, yeah, there was another lawsuit filed this week from one pop performer suing another one for ripping off a song. And it's just, I mean, if it's gotten
Wait,
to the point now.
Wait, is Lana Del Rey being sued by Radiohead for Creep?
Yes.
Well, didn't they rip off something that we know, and that's why they really don't have much to stand on? Creep is a ripoff of something else.
Right. So, I mean, nothing's new. And that's the thing, is that they're all looking at each other going, what are we going to write now? And the fact that it all comes out of the Matrix anyway. You've got five people who are writing every pop song. And, I mean, while there was always a Lieber and Stoller, while there was always a Goffin and King, while those things were always there, you also had Lennon and McCartney. You also had, you know, on and on down the line.
Nasty and McQuickly.
Yeah, exactly right.
Show that's going to get away with it without some acknowledgement.
Right. But yeah, that was the whole point, is that there were other things out there and there were people that were creating their own stuff in addition to, not to mention the fact that when it comes to the shit that they're writing for Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake, Goffin and King were thousands of times, light years ahead of that kind of crap.
Yeah, well, that's because you had a great writer like Carole King.
Exactly.
You've heard her demo of Porpoise Song, you know, and of Pleasant Valley Sunday. I mean, she never needed to write another song beyond those two. Those two would fill the legacy right there.
Indeed.
You know, that's how good she was. But then there's somebody like Bernard Taupin. You know, without Elton John, what happens is he winds up writing with a cabal of people a song like We Built This City.
Yeah.
And that is just not okay.
Right. And what was the guy who wrote all the stuff for Meatloaf? What was his name again?
Oh, God, Jim Steinman.
Right.
Oh, that blowhard.
So, yeah, right. Here we are. And once again, we've got nothing to do but lament the fact that the talented guys right now, unfortunately, are being swept to the edges and not given any credence or any ability to go out and do what they do.
Credence? Now, there was a band.
Hey, I like those guys.
Fogerty's a surly guy, but come on. That guy knew how to write a hit single.
Yeah, exactly. Surly.
Sleep.
He can be surly. He's a hell of a talented dude. So
put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
Well, all the way through that, and that's the thing, is that, you know, you look at that career, and it wasn't just a resurgence in the early 80s. It was John Fogerty finding his voice without credence. And not only did you have Center Field, but you also had Vans Can't Dance, which is just a killer song.
You got to, first of all, you got to hidey high. You got to run and jump.
Right.
And you got to be careful of lawsuits because you're going to get sued for rewriting one of your songs. Now, here's the stupid part about that lawsuit, though. I remember Zenz kept Saul Zenz, that is, for those who don't know, the head of Fantasy Records.
Right.
John Fogerty for The Old Man Down the Road, saying it was a rewrite of Lodi. Not by a long shot. It's a rewrite of Run Through the Jungle.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And he's the same writer. So you can't sue the guy for writing a song that he already wrote, because he's the same guy.
Yeah.
That's like when Stig sued himself.
Right. Well, if that was the case, then Chuck Berry would have no money left because he would have given it all to himself. Wait a minute.
Exactly. I mean, that was the stupidest of lawsuits.
Right.
Because I remember sitting there going, but wait a minute. How does this even work?
Yeah.
You know?
So that's the state of music at the moment.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the state of the union is another thing entirely. Oh, the speech aside, and we'll get to the speech, but the amount of shit that has happened in the last 7 days is, I mean, the pile is so high right now, and it kills me that in the wake of, right now we have how many guilty pleas? We have another one that's about to happen. You know, the one who was partners with Manafort, his lawyers all quit last week, and his new lawyers went right to Robert Mueller's office. What do you think's about to happen there? So all of this is stacking up. It's looking more and more like it's not going to necessarily be collusion about the election. What it's going to be is the reason that Donald Trump wouldn't release his tax returns, which is the fact that he's been laundering money for the fucking Russians for the last 25 years. That's what's going to take his ass down, because all of the guys that they're putting away right now or making plea deals with are guys who are involved in money laundering. So, you know, it looks like the next stop for Mueller is to go after Jared Kushner, to go after Dickhead Jr. and his stupid brother, and start knocking those dominoes over. And in the middle of all of that, Donald Trump's got to give a State of the Union address. Holy shit!
The thing is, though, apart from the fact that, yeah, it's a cringe watching the man speak.
Yep.
Because he's just an imbecile.
Right.
Yeah. There's no way around that. That's being as kind as possible. As far as him staying on track, he did. Because I think he was told by more than enough people, you cannot be Donald Trump.
Right. Read just the page and don't Trump say it. Right. A bloody word.
Exactly. Just read it as is and don't ad lib.
Yep.
They did a very astute job at bringing out the people in the audience, the special guests.
The props.
To try and soften things up. However, I will say this much, you know, I found it a bit more than egregious that none of the Democrats had the decency to stand up and applaud like the little kid who puts the flowers on soldiers' graves. I mean, there's right. no political agenda there. That's a really beautiful act as far as I'm concerned, because we seem to forget very easily the soldiers that we have and the ones that we had, you know, and nobody's been doing anything. So even if it's some little gesture like that by a child, I think that deserved a round of applause from everyone. And the Democrats just typically showboating and disgust me just as much as the Republicans do. And, you know, that family whose two daughters were murdered by,
MS-13, yeah, the gang. MS-13.
They're sitting there on their hands. Well, you know what? If it happened to you, or if it was a Democratic president, you'd be applauding, I'm more than sure.
Sure.
So
sure.
The hell with you. You know, take your lefty bullshit and go fuck yourselves along with the righty bullshit.
Exactly. And as we said, there's no leadership anywhere. It's complete void right now. And it's complete void. And I think that part of it is because they're all waiting to see what the end of this stupid, idiotic story is that we're writing right now. How bad are we going to look to our grandchildren when they learn about what's going on right now in history class 50 years from now?
But you know what? Going back to when we first started this version of our work together, in one of the earliest episodes, we very pointedly asked each other, what's the end game here?
Right.
The answer is, we don't know at this point. Something tells me with the way that it's going right now, because it's going to drag out. Trump's going to win another 4 years, but this time he'll win it handily, especially because what you just said is completely true. There is no leadership. There is a void. And you look at all those names that you and I had thrown out there when we thought, and that's the key word, we thought that these people had a modicum of, God help me, integrity and could be the leaders of the Democratic Party the way it should be led going into tomorrow. And you see right now how they've all become no different than all those that we hate.
Hacks. They're all hacks.
Bullshitters, liars. Fuck all of you. Fuck everyone. Fuck Cory Booker. Fuck Kirsten Gillibrand. Fuck Pocahontas. Fuck that Maxine Waters. And especially fuck you, Bernie. And now let's get to the state, the People's State of the Union in New York, because that infuriated me to no end. Now, if that isn't commie speak, I don't know what is.
Yeah, right. Welcome to the People's Republic of New York, right?
Yeah, led by fucking Warren Wilhelm, who goes by the name of Bill de Blasio.
Uh-huh.
And that fucking little meathead hack actor, Mark Ruffalo, who I will never watch another movie with that piece of shit ever again. Fuck that guy too.
I'm trying to think of any Mark Ruffalo movie that if I had not seen it, my life would be diminished in any way. Nope.
None. You know, unless you really like 13 going on 30, but that's only because of Jennifer Garner.
Oh, you mean turkey sandwich? I'll get to that later.
Those two just infuriated me beyond words that they put on this little dog and pony show. And basically it was another one of those Bill de Blasio knows better than all of you.
Yeah.
You're all idiots and you're all peasants and I'm the most wonderful thing since sliced bread. Well, you know what, de Blasio? Go fuck yourself. Because the great thing is, unfortunately, we're stuck with you for four more years as mayor, unless they do something with that case that they've been building against you. you'll never run again anyway.
Right.
Because no one anywhere is going to vote for you, motherfucker.
But it's the same story. And that's the real problem is that because people are so completely blinded by partisan politics, they don't understand that it's the same story. In his case and in Donald Trump's case, both, you have guys who are standing there going, don't pay any attention to the shitstorm around you. Everything's great and I did it. It's the same lie.
God help us. De Blasio and his chronic, and I do mean chronic, patting himself on the back with trying to take care of the homeless problem in New York. You know what his solution is? To arbitrarily, without a word of warning to the neighborhoods, build homeless shelters and put in people who are not what you would consider, I dare say, worthy of being put in a homeless shelter. These are criminals.
Uh-huh.
There is a difference between people who are homeless and in a plight. People who find themselves in that untenable situation of being homeless are not going to stay on the streets. They're not going to go begging. They're going to go to a shelter and bite the bullet as much as they hate it because they need a place to be.
Right.
The people that are out there now and these people that he's trying to use as his props, these are all the lowest common denominator. This is the criminal element out there. These are the junkies and the pushers and the skells. And the ones who want, you know, to either rob you of your money or beg and mooch because they don't want to do a damn bit of work. These are bums. That's what they used to call them when we were kids.
Yeah.
These were bums. It's very clear. And de Blasio is really overplaying his hand. It somehow got out that a homeless shelter was going to be built in what they very sarcastically refer to as Billionaire's Row, which is bullshit. But in this nice neighborhood. People freaked out, and justifiably so. You know, look, I don't want a homeless shelter in our neighborhood. We have I live in a lower middle class to upper working class neighborhood. I hate putting it in those class terms, but that's the only way to describe
it. That's the descriptive, though. Yeah, right. And everybody knows what you mean. Sure.
And have a very healthy mix of people here. You know, there's no racial divides here. Everybody is neighbors. You know, it's a nice neighborhood, a little rundown, and we definitely can use some amenities, but we definitely don't need a homeless shelter. It's bad enough that we have a methadone clinic not too far away. That's problematic enough, and that's more than enough for us to have to deal with, you know?
Sure. And, you know, you look at the state of politics here, and I live out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, the closest city to me is St. Louis, and it's about 30 miles away, which is not terribly far. But I'm out in the cornfields, man. I mean, my house, literally, before it was built 12 years ago, was a cornfield. And I'm fine out here. Life is good. And, you know, but at the same time, in the state of Missouri, I'm on the Illinois side. In the state of Missouri, and this made national news this week as well, they have a dipshit running for state legislature who said, well, I want my wife to have dinner ready for me at 6 p.m. every day. And it was just the same misogynistic bullshit that we've heard from these people. And you know, 20 years ago, they stopped saying it because they realized what a bunch of assholes it made them look like. This guy apparently didn't think so. And the thing is, he's got a better than average shot of winning at least the primary. On the Illinois side, there's a guy running unopposed for the state legislature. I hope he loses, but you know what?
He's a Holocaust denier.
And it's a very heavily Republican area of Southern Illinois. Yes, Illinois is a very blue state, but like everywhere else, you get out into the sticks and it's heavily Republican. And he's running unopposed as a Republican. So you tell me what's about to happen. Are they going to put a Holocaust denier asshole in the state legislature? Yeah, maybe.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, so, I mean, who can hold out a whole lot of hope for things to get that much better when these are the people, again, that are finding their way to worm themselves into the political fabric? And it's just, it's hideous and awful. But
yeah. Obviously, the Roy Moore episode taught nothing to no one.
Right. At least in Roy Moore's case, he lost. Barely, right. But he lost. Now, the one thing, going back to the Super Bowl, not to the game itself, but to the reason why we missed most of it, kind of accidentally on purpose, is that we went to the movies. And because of MoviePass, we have been going to the movies more and more, actually going to the theater, although, you know, there's a lot of streaming services now that have first run, you know, new releases that are available on streaming. But we've been going to the theater because it's nice. You know, it's fun. And with MoviePass, it's $10 a month. So, yeah, who's going to argue? But we went and saw The Shape of Water. Do you know anything about this movie?
I've heard it mentioned in places.
Essentially, the setup is that it's 19... Judging by the cars, it's 1960 or 61. And it's a sort of a Cold War fable about the U.S. government finding and then hiding essentially the creature from the Black Lagoon. And
that's right.
And this woman who is a cleaning lady at this, you know, government establishment falls in love with it, and then steals it. And then, you know, hijinks ensue. But there's Russians involved and there's all this other stuff. The reason to see this movie is that it looks incredible. And I'm not just talking about the creature itself. I'm talking about the overall set design. The look of the movie is amazing and transportative. However, the story is kind of crappy and the acting is good. But you're not going to see anything that's going to blow you away. And so it's fine. But it's not by any means my favorite movie of the year. And the year's only a month and a half old.
You know, if it weren't for the fact that I have a feeling there's supposed to be a message in this movie.
Oh, yeah, there is. And boy, do they beat you over the head with it.
That's the thing. And, you know, it's funny what we forgot to bring up in the Super Bowl yesterday with the commercials, because that was just the drum and fife chorus right there of, of you know, social justice warrior sales pitches, left, right, center. I mean, wow. Every one of those commercials sucked a big one.
Well, right. And they're still commercials. I mean, that's the thing. They're selling you shit by playing the social justice warrior game. What?
Right. And now it makes me not want to buy your shit.
Right.
The minute I saw 90% of those commercials, I was like, go fuck yourselves.
Yeah.
You're not getting my bucks, that's for sure. But I wasn't even jazzed by the fact that there's another Star Wars movie coming out in May, you know, the Solo movie.
It looks horrible.
Right. And let's face it, there's only one Solo. And he's a crotchety old Jew.
Yep.
There's only one Landau Calrissian. And he's probably drinking a Colt 45 right now.
Sorry,
but didn't you know Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian?
Right.
No, not going to happen. And who the fuck is playing Solo?
I don't know. Some guy.
There's only two Solos, okay? There's Han and there's Napoleon. That's it.
And we haven't seen either one of them in a while. But yeah, I didn't see the 45-second thing that they ran during the Super Bowl, but they've got a minute and a half long trailer out for it now. And if it was anybody else, meh, sure, why not? But it isn't. It's this guy. And, you know, I had this conversation with a movie critic friend of mine, and he said, Disney is terrified right now about this movie. They think it's going to be a disaster.
Which one? Solo?
Solo, yeah.
Why?
Because it's crap. And they think that it's going to be hard to buy this. The audience is not going to respond to this guy as Han Solo. He just doesn't pull it off. And they're really frightened that they've got another absolute flop out of the Star Wars franchise on their hands. But, you know, given, and granted, you can't really tell anything from a minute and a half long trailer, but I didn't see a single thing in it that made me think, wow, maybe I should go see that movie. So who knows? Maybe they've got a point. Maybe this is just going to be another disastrous blot on the franchise and everybody will move on and wait for the next real Star Wars movie.
Well, there's only one thing that could even remotely make anyone want to see it.
That's right.
How he meets the Wookiee. That's the only question.
Well, yeah, and exactly right. And once you know, then okay, fine, that's over with, and we can all go home again. But I don't know the way that I had trepidation about Zachary Quinto and Chris Pine, and they totally allayed it. I mean that movie, again, it wasn't perfect, but the first time that those two played in the Star Trek movie, It was great fun. And they...
The second one was bad.
Oh, well, yeah.
It was dull.
Right. But that wasn't their fault. They inhabited the characters and they, you know, nobody is going to walk out of that movie thinking, wow, it really was Shatner and Nimoy all over again. But they inhabited the characters in a credible way. From what I've seen from this trailer, this guy doesn't give a shit about Han Solo, and he's not... There's
he's not Han Solo. That's
right,
it.
Right.
You know, the whole point is that Harrison Ford has that certain something that I would say at least 75% of all actors in this day and age do not have.
Yeah.
That natural charisma and star quality.
Right.
You know? Father!
But you're right, but it was there before. I mean, it was there in American Graffiti.
I was about to say, shit, is Bob Falfa.
It was even there in the Love American Style thing that he did. I thought that was really good. And, you know, later on he becomes this other thing. But you're right, you could tell before this guy's going to be something. And it wasn't really even that much of a surprise that he was, of the three, he was certainly the most successful post Star Wars with the other stuff that he did. You know, he made some really good movies. He made some crap, but he made some really good movies.
Well, I mean, yeah. Was it 6 days, 7 nights? That, no.
Yeah. But I mean, Mosquito Coast, that's a good movie.
Where is the Lost Ark?
Right. Right.
And what's the second one?
Temple of Doom.
Temple of Doom. After that, they were bad.
Yeah.
But still, those two, great movies. Trying to think, what else did he do?
What was Witness? Was the one he did with Kelly McGillis?
Right.
And Lucas Haas. And there was another one in there.
He also did one where he...
There was one that didn't do well. And it was an okay movie, but the audience just didn't respond to it. And it was another one where he was playing against type. And I can't remember what it was.
There was a murder mystery that he did where Bonnie Bedelia played his wife. And he was accused of raping and murdering his mistress. When he hadn't.
That might be it. Yeah, that might be it. But again, you know, you talk about being accused of a murder he didn't commit. How about The Fugitive?
Right. And look who's in that with him. So you got two great actors.
Tommy Lee Jones, yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones, from the minute he was, what was it, Detective Yawn Nibble in The Eyes of Lurid Mess?
Right.
Classic, you know?
And,
great act.
You know, and you can sit through the Betsy just to see that incredible pair of knockers, but that's another story altogether. you ever see that movie, The Betsy?
Once.
Yeah. Oh, man, I don't even remember that girl's name, but holy shit. But, yeah, with Tommy Lee. The other thing that, of course, those movies, U.S. Marshals and The Fugitive had was Joey Pants. And I'm sorry, you put Joe Pantoliano in anything, I'll watch it.
Listen, he was the only good thing about La Bamba.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You could have been Ricky Zuela.
Come on, we all change our name. My last name's Cool.
Babo? Yeah, indeed. But, you know, I'm not the only one who saw movies because you finally got around to The Big Sick.
Yeah, and I actually was very surprised at how charming I thought it was. Yeah. It wasn't charming in a cute and cloying and, dare I say, predictable way that these movies tend to be.
Yep.
It was actually very sweet and very believable. The two leads had actual chemistry, and I'm not a big fan of Zoe Kazan to begin with. There's something about her that I find just kind of run-of-the-mill in most situations. But the way she played off of I can never pronounce Kumail's last name, but he's the guy who's from
Nanjiani.
Thank you. He's also the co-star of Silicon Valley.
Right.
Which he's hysterical in. He's really deadpan and he's really good, but there was a genuine emotion conveyed in this movie that you felt it. You actually felt it. And it's nice to be able to feel something when you're watching a movie.
Yeah. Well, it was
a long time from it.
Probably a little easier for him to pull off than most things because it is his story. I mean, that is his actual life. That's what happened with the woman that became his wife. He really did go through all of that, but still, that doesn't always mean anything. That doesn't always translate. He told it in a very honest way, and you could feel that.
And the thing is, you know, he major coup of casting, because I would have never put together Ray Romano and Holly Hunter as a married, believable couple.
As her parents, yeah.
Fantastic together.
Right.
And, you know, Ray Romano, who I just picture him as in Everybody Loves Raymond, is terrific as a dramatic actor. He really does have – he's got the chops. And, Jesus, I could listen to Holly Hunter all day.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding.
That is one girl I just absolutely adore.
Well, and
– absolutely adore her.
If you've never seen Kumail Nanjiani's stand-up, if you liked The Big Sick – go and seek out some of his stand-up stuff. It's fantastic. His sense of timing and his way of building a story and doing callbacks and all of that, his writing is just outstanding. So, he's done a couple of them, but there's an hour-long special out there that's brilliant.
The moment of that movie was just beyond brilliant when he meets the parents at the hospital for the first time. They're talking. And... you know, they ask him about 9/11. And totally straight face, he goes, "Oh, of course it was terrible. It was shocking. And we lost 19 of our best guys." That was just priceless. Absolutely priceless. That was worth the $6.99 we paid for pay-per-view alone.
Yeah.
But really, it is so nice to watch a movie and actually have feelings from it, you know, to sit there and be moved by it, you know. And yeah, you know that it worked out in the end, but the fact is a movie version doesn't always approximate the real life version.
Right.
For the sake of artistic liberties. But you're rooting for the character, and it's nice to root for a character. 9 times out of 10 you go into a movie and you come away not giving a shit either way. Well, that was a good movie, I suppose.
Yeah, and then you forget about it. An hour later it's gone.
It's kind of like having Chinese food.
Yeah, or going to that German Chinese restaurant, and an hour later you're hungry for power. On that note. As we get to the In Our Heads segment of the show, and I mean, we could seriously, there is so much more going on in the world, and we'll have all of next week's show to talk about it as we do our anniversary, our first anniversary. So I'll have to get you something paper for In Our Heads this
week. I can tell you what kind of paper to get. It's green.
Yeah,
it's called legal tender. Yeah.
Those are my favorites too. But the In Our Heads thing this week, I want to go back because an anniversary passed over the last couple of days. February 3rd of this year was 59 years, and it was 59 years from 1959, curiously enough, since we lost Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper, in that plane crash. And I didn't expect... you know, every year this one sneaks up on me a little bit, and then somebody mentions it, and I go, ah, yeah. And remember all of the great portrayals. I mean, start thinking about, because obviously 1959, it was 10 years before I was born. I have no actual feelings from the day because I wasn't around yet. But I start thinking about, I mean, even things like Gary Busey and the Buddy Holly story, which was just great. And you mentioned La Bamba a minute ago. And that's, I mean, I can actually watch that movie and be entertained by it. I recognize it's a lousy movie, but I can still be entertained by it. And there were several others that made reference to it. There was a movie called American Hot Wax that one of the main characters, this young kid who wants to get involved in the music business, is walking around through the whole thing because it was set in mid-1959, and he's walking around with a Buddy Holly Lives button on for the whole thing. And that kind of stuff, it's a weird sort of nostalgia when you weren't there when something happened. And yet, you know, there's been so much said and so much done, including American Pie, that, you know, you feel like you have some kind of connection to it. And what that set forward is this weird thing that happened. So 1959, we lost those three. 1969 and 1970, I mean, for crying out loud, Mama Cass and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, and I mean, on and on and on. There was like this purge at the end of the 60s where we lost all of this great talent. And then into 1980, where we lost, one of the Beatles, maybe? And, you know, John Lennon dies in December of 1980. September of 1980, we lose John Bonham, and Led Zeppelin goes up with him. And what they leave behind is the same thing that James Dean did so many years ago, which is the untapped potential. And I still think that with all of that great talent that was gone far too early, that it still goes back to Buddy Holly. I think about the albums and albums and albums worth of material that was never written because of that plane crash. And I think that he still is the one that had the most potential to change music and to move forward. Because in a very short period of time, in the 3 or 4 years that he was popular, he changed a ton. I mean, Peggy Sue into True Love Ways, that's night and day. I mean, that really is. That's Meet the Beatles to Revolver and Rubber Soul. So I wonder if you're on board with that, if there's another performer that you think is representative of that untapped potential, the what could have been, that, you know, makes them legends in rock and roll.
I think so. I mean, let's talk about Buddy Holly for a moment, though, because I think we all have an emotional investment in the Buddy Holly story, as it were. You know, we grew up with the music.
Right.
We are of that era because our parents listened to it, you know, and you know, God knows my parents had the singles, all the Buddy Holly singles.
Yep.
The thing is, Buddy Holly was evolving as, even though he was going out there and playing things like Peggy Sue and Oh Boy and Not Fade Away, you know, as you just mentioned, you know, the evolution into something like True Love Ways, but then a track like Learning the Game, you know,
yeah.
Where he got, because the whole thing that most people don't know is that Buddy Holly had moved to New York, A, to be closer to Decca Records, because the industry was here, B, because he had kind of found that there was a thing happening in New York that was a lot more serious than just, you know, I love you, Peggy Sue kind of writing.
Right.
There was a lot more depth and a lot more, I guess, room to mature the way he wanted to mature under his own terms. And that would have been free of the crickets.
Yes.
There was no question about that.
Yep.
And I think Learning the Game was kind of like the first step on that roadmap of where he was going to go.
When you love her and she doesn't love you, you're only learning the game. When she says that you're the only one she'll ever love, when you find that you are not the one she's thinking of, feeling so sad and you're all alone and blue, that's when you're learning the game.
He probably would have done something in a folky vein, you know?
Yeah.
He may have definitely taken it with the, along with the orchestrating. Let's keep in mind, in that short amount of time, this was a guy who went from being produced by Norman Petty to producing himself, double-tracking himself. He did things, studio innovations, that nobody else had done at that point, except,
right,
you know, always mind what the producer says. Buddy Holly was calling his own shots. So that's one. But right on the heels of Buddy Holly, and it's interesting that you put those two-year brackets, you know, 69, 70, 79, 80, you know. In 1960, we lost Eddie Cochran.
Right.
Who was another one who had a ton of potential, you know. Just by the three songs of his that seemed to live on, you know, Summertime Blues, Come On Everybody, and Something Else. You know, the guy knew how to write a song.
Yep.
And he had the chops. The problem is we didn't get to see it. You know, it's the proverbial what ifs. But I think he was definitely somebody that could have led the vanguard. And I think Buddy Holly would have definitely taken the mantle, is simply because had he not died, Elvis was in the army. And what happened when Elvis came back from the army in 1960? It was schlock.
Right. It was completely different. It was different guys.
It was return. You know, his return was it's now or never. Which is Solo Mio, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, into Can't Help Falling in Love, into Are You Lonesome Tonight? Somehow, he managed to regain his form with Little Sister, although that was snuck in as a B-side to a really wet song like Marie's the Name of His Latest Flame. But most stations turned it over and made Little Sister the big hit.
Right.
Because that was just such an unexpected turn from Elvis. back to being Elvis, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the thing is that when you listen to that record today, that sounds as exquisite now as it did then, because it's stripped down. It's guitar. Obviously, somebody's playing a Fender bass because you can hear the click of the pick, and really crisp drums, and that's it. You know, and Elvis's voice unfettered and just, you know, balls out. Now, were there others that I could think of that had potential? That's a very broad question, because look, for argument's sake, when Jim Morrison died, you know, he was already being laughed at for being a buffoon.
Yep, and he was acting the part too, sure.
Right, so he was living up to the I'm an asshole kind of thing.
Mark Bolan's a kind of an interesting name to throw in there.
I have my moments with Bolan, but the thing is, Bolan had a very long career. You know, it started in 1965 with his first single. I think the first single was The Wizard, and then the second one was The Third Degree. And then he was in John's Children, and John's Children were just terrible. And then the first Tyrannosaurus Rex records were these hippy-dippy folk things that were just insufferable because they were so twee and so pretentious. He finally hit the formula with Ride a White Swan.
Catch a bright star in a place you know your forehead. Say a few spells and baby, there you go. Take a black cat and sit you down your shoulder. And in the morning you'll know all you know.
And Hot Lamb, and then, of course, the Slider album, you know, and Electric Warrior were just, you know, monumental. But the thing is, Mark Bolan was too much of a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
It was way too samey. He wasn't somebody that seemed to... The one thing I will say about Mark Bolan is this, though. For whatever reason, maybe it's because he was one of the few that they would give a shout-out to, but he took to the punks, and they in turn loved him because they were all influenced by him. So he gave them an outlet with his TV series, because if you ever get to see some of them, everyone was on there. The Jam made their first live appearance on that show. Generation X, The Damned. The Damned actually toured with Bolan and said he was a truly lovely guy, you know, right before the crash. But I don't think he, because he had that long career, he just never, it never developed here beyond a minor blip with, you know, Get It On. A minor blip, you know, when we lost Lennon, should have never even bothered releasing Double Fantasy because it's a terrible album.
Yeah.
Yoko's songs are much better than his. it's that simple. I'd rather listen to Kiss, Kiss, Kiss than Starting Over, because that's just bad Elvisisms. It's a hard question to answer. It's a good one to ponder, but it's a hard question to answer because then you have to start going back into the books and finding out, well, who, quote, died before their time?
Right, you know? Right.
Who can you think of that, you know, there was all that promise? You know, you have it a lot easier with actors, I think, you know, like James Dean or Brandon DeWilde or Peter Duell, you know, people who are just beginning to hit strides, like, wow, this guy's got something, and then all of a sudden he's gone.
Right. Well, and the thing is, with the two women that we mentioned at the end of the 60s, what's Mama Cass going to do after the Mamas and the Papas? I mean, great voice.
She was doing the Sophie Tucker thing, right. You know? She was doing, you know, vaudevillian shtick. She was doing Yiddish theater in a popular forum, really. I mean, that was her bag.
Right. And as far as Janis Joplin,
you know, Dream a Little Dream of Me, which was from the 20s.
Right. And as far as Janis Joplin goes, I don't mind her. I wouldn't call myself a fan, but I think, okay, Big Brother and the Holding Company and a couple of other interesting tracks. And what more was there?
Really, right.
What more growth was there there?
Right. Hendrix. What could Hendrix do besides? I mean, he peaked on that first album.
Yep.
Are You Experienced is like a greatest hits album.
Yeah, really. It's a masterpiece. Sure.
You know, after that, then what? It just meanders a lot. You know, it's him doing guitar masturbation.
Right.
You know? It's like Townsend put it perfectly. He said, you know, his ego got in the way, the band got in the way, the fans got in the way, the women got in the way, the drugs got in the way, and worst of all, he got in the way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a guy who knows what he's talking about, you know?
Right.
Because there you go. Somebody who lived to tell, because it wasn't going to be Keith Moon. He was the drummer. But Townsend, as a writer and a reporter, you know, he's someone who has done it. And I think he's done it with a lot of grace and dignity. And I don't really care for when people go into the whole backlash of the who making money. Good. They're old men. Let them make money. Yeah, they're families.
Right.
You know, God bless.
Yeah. Well,
okay, I got one. I got it. The one guy who definitely, there was so much more to come. And you knew there would be more to come. And it's painful that it didn't come. Jim Croce.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd even begun to hit stride yet.
Yeah. And the same could be said, you know, what you were talking about with the fact that when you've got a guy like Harry Chapin, who had a good long career and did so much stuff, where's he going to go next? And in 1989, you know, again, end of a decade, and we lose another huge name. But really, how much more was Stevie Ray Vaughan going to give us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all well and good to play the same blues riffs over and over again. I mean, Eric Clapton made a career of it.
Right, and he was real good at it. I mean, Stevie was great at it. It sounded good, but...
the thing is, I don't think... The one thing nobody wrote when they were writing the book of rock and roll... Nobody wrote how do you age with dignity and grace.
Yeah,
it's a really good question to ponder. But yeah, you know, and the reason why I brought up Jim Croce is because I was just listening to him the other day, remembering when I was a kid and how affected I was when I woke up on that October morning, I think it was, and heard on ABC radio that and a plane crash took the life of singer Jim Croce, who is right now number one on our charts with Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. And I was so upset.
Yep.
I was like all of 8 years old. And that really affected me, you know, because I love You Don't Mess Around with Jim and Operator and you know, that first I Have to Say I Love You in a Song, you know, all those. Such a masterful songwriter, because he could turn a phrase. He wrote melodies, you know. He had that certain something.
Yeah, and he could be soulful, and he could do ballads, and, you know, he could be sappy without, again, getting cloying. And, yeah, it was just, it's pleasant stuff to listen to.
And the thing is, he wasn't exactly, quote-unquote, a young man. He was 30 when that plane crashed.
Right.
So he wasn't, it wasn't like a 22-year-old like Buddy Holly was, you know?
Yep.
But, you know, he'd struggled, he hadn't gotten anywhere, and suddenly it was finally happening.
Well, you know, I know we've missed some, and I know that they'll be in the comments section down at the bottom of the page. And by the way, I did have one song roll through my head this week, and this one may make its way into our In Our Head segment for the next broadcast. But for whatever reason, John Astley's Jane's Getting Serious occurred to me this week, and I thought, yeah. And I thought, you know what? It's been...
Yes.
35 years since I heard that song, and this is the first time in 35 years that I thought about it. So I'm going to go back and listen to it a couple more times, and we'll see if we can work something out for the In Our Head segment next time. In the meantime, Rob Ross, we will do our anniversary broadcast next time around, and have yourself a great week.
You too, brother. Just think, a year ago we wouldn't have thought that the future's so bright we've got to wear shades. You know, we were just about to start this little, this little adventure as President Asshole was being inaugurated.
Oh.
And here we are, and that man has given us so much fodder, so much to work with, and so have all the assholes that have been traveling in his wake, on the left and on the right.
That's right.
So to them I say, thank you, because I just got plenty more to shotgun you with.
Yeah, just remember, if you don't applaud loudly enough, it's treason. Rob, have a great week, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about him next time.
Definitely. Have a good one, brother. I'll see you later.